Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
As the Vietnam War rages overseas, four friends make a vow. For the next 2 weeks, they'll live for each other and for each day. Welcome to New Books in Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm G.P. Gottlieb, the host of this channel. I'll be talking to Sharon Solwitz, author of a prize-winning collection of short stories and a dark novel called Bloody Mary. Today, we'll be discussing her new novel, Once in Lourdes, which tells the story of teenagers in a fictional town in Michigan who make a suicide pact. In the two-week span in which the novel takes place, during the summer before their senior year of high school, the lives of Kay, CJ, Saint, and Vera will change beyond their expectations, and what they gain and lose will determine the novel's outcome. Hi, Sharon. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Galit. I'm glad to be here.
So let's start with a few words about you. Can you tell us where you were born and raised, where you went to school? A little bit about your previous books?
Sure. I was born in Pittsburgh, spent 6 months there. I have no memory of that period, but I grew up in Cleveland, lived there for about 18 years, went to school at Cornell. I was, in fact, when it was time for me to go to college, I was allowed a 350-mile radius of Cleveland, and I went as far east as I could, which was Cornell, and then met and married a guy who I eventually divorced, but he was from Chicago, and that's how come I live here right now. Lots of stuff happened in between. We were serious hippies. I lived on a commune. We went to India in search of enlightenment. We rode horses across. We went across from Zurich to Bombay. Basically overland with hitchhiking and walking and taking a bus or a train or two. But then things weren't working out, went back to Chicago. I was sort of in desperate straits then, went to school. I'm one of the later people to get a PhD and also late to have a book and late to have a real job. I mean, here I am, you know, what we call a certain age, and I'm sort of grateful that I had a wild and crazy youth, and things worked out decently. Books. I published my first book, I think I was in my early 50s, maybe 51, and had just graduated. It was Blood and Milk, and it was a collection of short stories that I'd been working on for the last 10 years. That book did fairly well. I published it with Saraband, and they also it took my next book, which is a novel. And my third book is Once in Lourdes. And since then, I have another book that was taken, but in an odd way. It just won a contest probably about a month ago. Called the Christopher Doheny Contest, and it will be published in Audible or audio, I guess, as an audio book, maybe by audible.com, I'm not sure. But it's a book that's looking for a press.
What an interesting story. And I'm looking forward to the next book because I love Nelson Lord. And I'd like to ask you, first of all, about that. On the jacket, it's described as a gripping, haunting novel about the power of teenage bonds. Do you think that's what Once in Lourdes is about?
Well, it's funny to think about your book after you've written it, because then I can talk about it, you know, like a, you know, like a book reviewer or a reader. When I was writing it, I didn't know what it was about. I started out with a single image, which I just wanted to flesh out and see what would happen. I mean, it was an image of four kids, high school age, and they were they just made a suicide pact. Didn't know why. They were standing on they're standing on a cliff, holding hands. And the plan is to jump together. And it was, so there was something I think to do with friendship in that image, because the idea that they would commit suicide, it wasn't so much things are desperate, but, or maybe it wasn't only that things are desperate, but we love each other and we're going to do this act together. And then as I wrote the book, it became, I think, like primarily really about their love for each other and how it changed with the pact that they make, how it changed with the events that occurred. You know, I think in fiction, things happen, you know, sometimes because of character. You know, you do something that just is something that the character would do because of how proud they are or fierce they are or angry they are. They do something out of, you know, their nature. But sometimes things are accidental. And so that combination of accident and, you know, sort of this illusion of purpose runs novels. Or at least this is something that I think about now and that I teach students. So anyway, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. Were any of those characters based on your students? I know you've been teaching at Purdue.
The characters were not based on anyone that I knew, which is, and I got to say, this is the first time I've ever written a piece where I didn't know the characters right off. And when I first started writing, I would write to solve some murky problem something that I didn't understand, I would be trying to figure out in course of the writing. So one of the first story I ever published was about a girl who's 28 and she's going back to her 10-year high school reunion. And she's disappointed in herself because back in high school, she was a star and she's no longer a star. And she's going back with that sort of burden of her past on her. And this is something that I had gone through and felt, you know, we had very strange feelings about, couldn't figure out what to do. I mean, there was really nothing to do. It couldn't figure out what it meant, my going back there. So that was what I used to write. Now, these characters, they began with the one character of Vera. She's one of the four high school kids. And I had the image of her before I had anybody else. It just sort of came into focus that she had a damaged hand. And everyone else was, you know, was physically perfect, but this one with the damaged hand was key. And starting with her, I developed the other characters in relation to her. I developed her in relation to her hand. And there's a process that I use that is kind of like a playing with opposites, looking for images that either express or express the opposite of what I'm, you know, of what I want to convey about a character. And I play with that. I use that technique. Actually, it's a technique to get my characters.
So Kay is the narrator, and she's struggling with her weight and her mother's early death. So who's her opposite? And how did you figure out those? Who are the two opposites?
I first was Vera. And because Vera had the damaged hand, I wanted her to also have some positive traits. You know, I know this sounds really mechanical, but it's like, okay, which positive trait will I grace her with? And I gave her a beautiful, controlled body, skill in ballet. She was a ballerina and a mouth. I mean, it seems to me that somebody who's got a damaged hand would have had to work hard to develop something that she could face the world, you know, to protect herself on account of. And then when I had, you know, so there is this sort of beautiful, mouthy, troubled, very attractive person. And I thought, Kay's got to be the opposite. So let's give her a weight problem. And so that was the first trait that I thought when I was developing Kay. You know, and after I could, you know, so I would work with these characters, like think about them until I could see them. And then I could see their families. And I had to make myself into a kind of, I don't know, amateur psychologist, thinking, okay, given this, what kind of family would they have? Must they have? And then what else can I add to that that interests me just for the hay of this? So I didn't have to make CJ Jewish, but I ended up doing that because I know something about Judaism, and also I know a little bit about the Holocaust, and I know someone who's a Holocaust survivor, he's the son of that. And I thought, okay, let's, and I put that together as kind of his background, and he, with his voice, which I didn't know at first, it grew out of that, you know, those facts.
And all four of the kids have such terrible relationships with their parents, especially today with his father. Why are the parents also doing that?
Well, first of all, I don't know whether this is probably not true, but I'll tell you what I was about to say anyway, that it has something to do with the fact that they would consider suicide, but that's not true. It's the fact that they would consider suicide and not talk to their parents about it, almost requires dysfunction. But there's also, I don't know, there's a book that I teach from by Janet Broway called Writing Fiction. And one of her edicts is only trouble is interesting. And when I think about people and their relationships with their parents, the ones who get along really well with their parents, that takes, you know, I even, there are no good images of that, or the images of that tend to be really similar to one another. Uh-huh. But dysfunction, boy, is way more interesting to me. You know, plus when I think of my parents, we weren't all that dysfunctional, but what fascinates me, what I write about, are the problem spots. You know, the times of great pain. I mean, that's what I remember. Or the times of relief from pain when something good happens to reconnect.
Hmm. Why do all four? Oh, okay. What about the complicated? All four of them have complicated sibling relationships. Can you discuss anything about that without giving away surprises?
Well, you know, I think of Vera and her brother as being very close. And them, mm-hmm. you know, having truly, you know, a very loving sibling relationship. Things happen, but that they were kind of a mainstay, the two of them, against the difficult mother and difficult father, who are difficult in different ways. Kay's background was really personal because I had an aunt who was very close to the family who killed herself, and she was also anorexic. And that that happened when I was 16, and it was one of the, you know, kind of major traumas of our family's experience together. So that was something. I mean, that was one of the only really personal thing. I mean, when I developed Kay, I didn't know that would be when I started to write about her and thought suicide. It seemed right that she would have that kind of mother, or it seemed like I could write her as a character with, you know, by appending, if I can say that, the thing that happened with my family. And so there Kay comes into focus.
I'm so sorry you went through that, but what an interesting way of sharing the pain that you felt. Speaking about Kay, she creates all these lovely little illustrations throughout the book. And her first drawing is of her physics teacher, I remember. I wonder if you ever caught one of your students sketching this portrait of you at some point. Where did that come from? And who did those illustrations?
I did them. Okay. And I did that, the first portrait that I did of the physics teacher, I did online with a mouse. It was really fun to do. And so I started to do them all with the mouse, but I couldn't, some of them were too hard to do with the mouse, and I ended up drawing them. But all the drawings are mine. And I was the one who doodled in class. Okay. You know, it was a way of keeping attentive.
Yeah.
So Kay got my artistic, you know, because I was a writer and an artist, and tried to figure out for a while. I was trying to figure out which road I would go down.
The illustrations are lovely. They're really well done. Will you talk for a little bit about the setting, the park and the bluff in the fictional town of Bluebird?
Sure. First of all, Lourdes, Michigan doesn't exist. I wanted the novel to be set in Michigan just because, first of all, it had to be set in the Midwest for the ending and for I don't know, to fit in with my knowledge base, because I'm Midwestern and I lived a short while in California, but too short to have a good enough feel for it. So had to be somewhere in the Midwest, and it needed a bluff. Well, Michigan got the
right,
nod,
right.
Because I traveled for my husband and I were looking for a second home for a little while. We used to have a house together in Wisconsin, and sold it. And then when the kids were a little bit older, we decided, well, maybe we could, with the money, buy a home if it's inexpensive in Michigan. So we took a ride, and we went up, you know, all along the east coast of Lake Michigan, and looked at houses, and we found there was a house there. We walked, and we were just looking at houses, and we didn't have a realtor. There was a peach tree in the front, and we knew that it was for sale for, I think it was $30,000, and it was on the lake. So we walked around back, and my God, the back, it was a bluff. It was, I mean, you could fall from, if there wasn't a fence on it. And you could see there was the lawn that extended all the way towards the, you know, towards the lake. Then we walked up there and looked down, and there was the beach below, you know, a pretty fairly horizontal drop. And we thought, we didn't buy the house on account of, well, there's an image in the book about the eroding of the backyards. And that was something we saw. This yard was maybe 100 feet. But we could see that the grass was growing down the bluff, and you could see that this was an eroding bluff. So that was the image of the house, of the place. And then I just invented the park where they meet, and the town where they meet. And I, you know, the Lourdes didn't come until very late in the game. I didn't know that it was going to be at a place called Lourdes. I was looking around. I Googled names of towns in Michigan and found these cool ones like Valhalla. You know, I think there's another one called Hell, Michigan. And then Lourdes came to me for no good reason that I could explain. I just decided I wanted to call it Lourdes. And then once I did, other things came into place, like the fountain, you know, and why someone might ask me, why are you calling it Lourdes? I don't know. I like the name. So, and then of course, but after that question sort of ferments for a little bit in my brain, I go back to the novel and see if I can find some places where I can do more, sort of description of the background. You know, and part of writing, probably as you know, is, you know, you put something in and then you have to go away, do something else. And then you look at it and make sure that it fits. And that also the fact that you've added a whole bunch, many, many new words means you probably have to take out something to rebalance it. But a lot of it is a kind of cut and paste and hone process.
Well, how long did it take you to write this book?
At least 20 years.
That is interesting.
I started in the 90s.
And how did you know you were done?
Well, I thought that I was done a lot earlier than 2018 or 2017. But it took a while for me. But I probably finished a draft in 3 years. Yeah, but that story, it didn't have Kay as narrator. It had four different voices that chimed in, and it didn't take place in 1968. It took place in the present. So it took place in 1999, and then it took place in the year 2000, and then the year 2001. But after 2001, it was getting harder to have it like usefully take place in the present, because it was taking me a long time to write well enough to publish, and the present kept changing. Mm-hmm. You know, phones kept changing. Oh God, if they had cell phones, they wouldn't have had much of a problem. And then 9/11 changes the whole system of what people think about and talk about. So I was not, you know, like making it, but the year 1999 wasn't that interesting a year for me. I mean, I had to pause the present time because I wasn't going to be able to catch up with it. And then I decided to go back to a time that I had strong feelings about, which was 1968.
Speaking of 1968, two of the characters take that road trip to Chicago, and it was the summer, and they happened to wander into the protest and violence during the National Democratic Convention. So were you writing from personal experience there?
A little bit of personal, a little bit of Google.
I mean, I looked. Were you there?
I was there, but I wasn't there on the very day that they were there. I was in Chicago at the time. Steve and I, my first husband, were actually the ones who had gone to see the movie Weekend instead of being our best political selves. But the next day we went and joined the protest and walked around and got a whiff of tear gas, not as much as they did. So I had to do, I had to imagine myself there. I mean, I had to do more imagination, more imagining than remembering.
Right. But it was fun that they went down there and they participated in a world event.
Yes. I mean, and that was something that, I mean, that didn't come into the novel until a whole lot later. I mean, I probably 10 years had passed and it didn't end with that. But when it came into focus, that as an ending, I understood something about the novel that I hadn't understood before. And that was the need for a larger community, that they were stuck, that they were, kind of walled off, you know, in their little group of four, and that there was a kind of stickiness to that.
stickiness. So how did you choose a two-week period between them signing the suicide pact and following through with it? Was that, did that change, or was that always the case?
Well, this is funny, but I have a writing group in Chicago. And when I first took this, when I first wrote the story, it was 6 weeks. And I took the novel, the first chapter, you know, and I think the last line of the pact was they had, instead of they had 2 weeks, it was they had 6 weeks. And my friend Garnet Cohn, a fine writer in herself, said, that's too much time. It would be so much more tense if it were less time. So I thought that I didn't want the whole thing to occur in one day. So I gave it 2 weeks and figured, you know, I could change it at any moment, but 2 weeks sort of worked out as a way of writing it, you know, as a time frame that was workable.
It was very tense. Okay, am I right to think that everyone except Vera finds some comfort from the suicide pact? She seems filled with angst and crazed with guilt. Can you talk more about her and how she differs from others?
Oh boy, but she's the most fraught because she's the only one she's the one whose guilt is overwhelming for many reasons. I mean, not wanting to give away plot elements, but her Catholicism lends her to a sensitivity. Of course, that connects her. They all feel guilty in one way or another, but because she's done something so recently that makes her ashamed of herself, she's the one who really wants to. It's her idea. She's got everyone involved in this. And after everyone is involved in it, she's got twofold guilt because they're doing it with her, and she's the one who wants to blot herself out. It's as if, she's sort of boxed in from the get-go. She's almost a kind of a Greek tragedy character, someone who is not going to find her way out of her situation, but that everything that she does is going to make it more likely, you know, more impossible to get mm-hmm. away from. Whereas the others are not quite so, you know, sort of like embroiled in their, you know, in tragedy.
Are these kids, do you think, more or less confused than teenagers today? You work with college students who aren't that different in age from these four. What do you think?
Oh, boy. See, I think some kids are less confused. A lot of kids are. But I deal with a lot. I have a lot of writer college kids. And a lot of the writers want to be writers because they have troubling backgrounds. I mean, I think that there's something about a troubling background and this need to write. I don't know if everyone who writes feels this way, but I think I see writing as a way of making oneself whole when you don't feel that way. And you're trying to find boundaries and, an environment in which you can understand yourself. And understand yourself and love yourself at the same time. And by putting parts of yourself in different characters, you enlarge your world. And that enlargement, I think, is really important. You know, it's kind of enlarging and also giving more context to it. So I guess I know people who, I know many people who are as troubled as my four. And also people who don't seem that way.
Well, they all look normal from the outside, except for Vera with her hand. Yeah, you can't see what's inside. So how is Once in Lourdes connected to your previous novel, your short story collection? Are there any commonalities?
Well, in terms of theme, I think almost, this is something that I've even like read about myself. I mean, that I take a kind of normal situation and I intensify it, or I take a character who, you know, has some wildness and I make that wildness more ferocious. And I think that's, I don't know, kind of a writing habit of mine, or it's something that I do with, you know, almost that I've done with my, in my short stories and in my second novel as well. You know, people taken to kind of doing something that pushes the limits of their, you know, of their daring. So that's, it's similar in that way. It's different in that it was a departure because it was the first one that required imagination, like more imagination than personal experience. Suicide wasn't a part of my suicide in terms of my aunt wasn't a part, was a part of my upbringing, but not young persons. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anyone, nor were my friends, nor was I suicidal then. So I felt like I was, like one of the reasons it took me so long to write was everything had to be imagined, and like burnishing my imagination is a slow process.
So Sharon Solwitz, you've traveled the world, you've sought and hopefully found enlightenment in India, you've taught English all around the Midwest, you've published, you've received prizes, and now you've written a really haunting novel. I read it in a day because I couldn't put it down, and I'm still thinking about it 2 weeks later. So I wish you a lot of success. I've taken up a lot of your time, but could you just answer the traditional New Books question before we say goodbye? What's next for you?
Boy, I've been working. I just came back from Mexico, and I was working there on this a new novel, and I have a draft. But until this summer, I didn't like the draft. But now I'm sort of, I became thrilled with it sometime in the middle of my Mexico vacation as I was working it. It's about, well, there's two boys. They're brothers. One goes to Columbia College in Chicago, and the other one goes to Columbia University in New York. And that was what I started with. I just thought it was funny, the idea of these two Columbias and who these boys are. Their mother is a school teacher in Chicago, and her husband has just left her. And at the beginning of the book, her son, who goes to Columbia in New York, he's also gone to Israel after he's dropped out of Columbia, gone to Israel, and he's working on the same kibbutz that the mother was on when she met her husband, who's a faithless husband. And at the beginning of the book, he has stopped emailing her, and she doesn't know where he is. And the book is going to be a quest novel because she and her difficult younger sister are going to be traveling to Israel to try to find the son Jacob.
It sounds like a great project. I love quest novels that take me around the world. So good luck. And thank you again for being on the New Books podcast. And I hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.